Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is it Goodby or Godby?
Godby.
Godby, okay, thank you. Julie and David Godby, appellants versus the City of Rapid City, Appalachia. For the appellants, we have Mr. Stephen Beardsley and Mr. Michael Beardsley, attorneys from Rapid City. Mr. Stephen Beardsley, I understand you'll be presenting this morning. All right. And for the Appalachia City of Rapid City, we have Mr. Robert Galbraith, an attorney also from Rapid City. With that, Mr. Beardsley, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to come to you to present what we believe are two major errors that were performed or done by the trial court. This is a case in which Julie Godby is an incomplete quadriplegic as a result of the actions and inactions by the City of Rapid City. But I think it's important to cover the history prior to Julie Godby's incident on July 27, 2015. As far back as 1992, the City of Rapid City had a bike safety task force, and in the bike safety task force, they determined that parallel grates were dangerous and defective. Parallel grates on the side of the road where bicycles go. And I'm going to get to the rest of the history, but it's interesting to note that in Rapid City, they tell you you have the rights of any vehicle, but you can only go 4 feet from the curb. You're not supposed to be out in the lane, you get 4 feet. Our South Dakota statutes even say go right next to the curb. So we have two statutes that Julie Godby and David Godby were following that day on July 27th. So in 1992, they said the parallel grates are defective. In addition, what happened then in 2004 was that the City of Rapid City took over this highway. This highway was Highway 238. It's 1.3 miles from the Campbell turnoff to Highway 44. In 2006, the City of Rapid City, again, this time it was called the Bikeway Walkway Plan, and it too said no parallel grates because they're dangerous and defective and people will fall in the grates. And I'll get to what happened to Julie Godby, but she went in the grate and now she's an incomplete quadriplegic. In 2006, again, there was a federal mandate that said no parallel grates were allowed, and we get federal funds, Rapid City does, and they have to abide what the federal mandate is. 2007 was a particularly important year in regards to this case because on this case, a specification was passed in the City of Rapid City to not have parallel grates that run along the traffic, but have perpendicular grates. And so what they did is they then, when they passed that specification, you'll see that in the photographs across the street, 25 feet away, they had replaced the grate with a perpendicular grate after 2007 in the spec and prior to Julie Godby's July 27, 2015, when she went into the grate. Then again, in 2011, it was called the master plan. 2011, the master plan for Rapid City said drainage grates must be retrofit to either be perpendicular, honeycomb, or there's a combination of both that's in the master plan. And they said, you need to do this because these are defective.
What was the legal effect of this master plan? Was it passed by the city council?
Yes. All of these were passed by the city council, other than the federal mandate, but the federal mandate came along with it. Every single plan was passed by the city council. So they agreed to this and agreed that they needed to do this. Interestingly, and we'll get to this particular grate, the evidence was destroyed. What's interesting in this history is that Mr. Brumbaugh, who is the 30B6 witness, who they're bound by, the 30B6 testimony, said that these grates were welded on prior to 2015, and it's in his testimony, it's in our brief. So in the history from 2011, then they welded on these grates, and then you see the pictures of the grates where there's some of the bars are gone, And some are completely gone, and some are just mangled up, and they didn't fix them.
When this grate disappeared, were they replacing other grates, or is this the one and only that was in the area replaced?
They replaced a numerous, almost 100 grates.
Okay.
And interestingly, they destroyed this grate so we can't test it. They threw it all in a pile, and then they come and say, well, we didn't destroy the grate. They threw it out in the snow and the rust, and you can't identify which one, so they've taken it. And in fact, Mr. Brumbaugh again indicated, yeah, I couldn't find it if I wanted to. And he said, usually they take them and they end up at some mill and they take the steel. So he couldn't find it anyway. So now we have photos of the grates all the way along the side of the road. It's the south side of the road. And these mangled grates that we've presented to the court. 25 feet away, you got a perpendicular grate. The history is important for a number of reasons. First of all, this statutory construction is important because the court got that wrong. The court said it's narrowed to that grate. It's the defect in the highway. And the statute itself, 31.32.10, says if any highway, culvert, or bridge is damaged. It doesn't limit it to part of the highway. It doesn't limit it to part of a bridge. I gave an example to my partners, and I said, so what if the bridge had a hole in it at first? And they noticed, knew it, fixed a hole on the other side, and then didn't bother to fix all the other holes on the bridge. It would be the bridge, because it says, if any highway, culvert, or bridge is damaged, this highway is damaged. And they had actual and constructive notice of that, and I'll get to that in a minute. But the purpose of this statute, we're not talking about common law, we're talking about this statute. We know that. It says, and it used to say in whole or part, but it doesn't need to say that because if it's damaged, it's damaged. And if it's partly damaged, it's damaged. If it's wholly damaged, it's damaged. And it endangers the public. That's part of the statute.
Mr. Beardsley,
yes, sir.
That's precisely.
I'm sorry, I missed part of that.
The damage text that you're talking about from 31.32.10, is the damage the defective, as you say, the defective or dangerous condition of the parallel grates, is that the damage that renders it unsafe, or is the damage the crossbars that you suspect were there, but were then damaged or taken off by the snowplow? Is it the former or the latter? And if that's the latter, how does the notice work in
the moment? Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just going to take the words of the statute, okay? If any highway, culvert, or bridge is damaged, so if the highway is damaged, it's the culverts themselves that are damaged. Part of it is they're is the damage of that grate, but also all the successive ones. And in fact, the testimony was, Judge Justice, that they wouldn't go out and weld on a few and skip a few and weld on a few and skip a few. That would make no sense. In fact, I had four city employees, Dale Tech, the city engineer, Trevor Schmelz. They're not going to go out and skip them. So it's our position that if you're not going to go out and skip them and you've welded on them, and Mr. Brumbaugh, 30B6 witness, that we specifically labeled as 30B6 before we started. He spoke for the city and he said they were welded on beforehand. And what's interesting, Judge, is, can I?
Go ahead, please.
And I'm gonna get to the notice part too. Yeah, so I wanna point out what Judge Brown did in his opinion. And they put it in their brief, actually, they quoted it. He said, East St. Patrick Street was built with wildly dangerous grate system. And it says the city realized it and had problems with the grate even back in 2007. Problems with this grate. He's referring to the grate. So they knew there was problems with the grate, and the judge even found there were problems with the grate, and that's exactly what we're saying, is the grates were bad and the damage, the highway was damaged. And they said, the city may have welded on grate 4 before the accident, and those welds may have failed. Right. We're talking about a question of fact of whether or not there was notice. There's numerous questions of fact about notice. If fact, we listed 9 in our brief. 9 questions of fact. And here's the deal. And what's most important is the case of Fritz versus Howard Township. In 1997, some of us were practicing law then. Justice Gilbertson was actually on that court, and it was written by Judge Sabers. And the quotes in there are absolutely critical. And there are a number of them. First of all, they held, you only need construction notice. They reversed it with Justice Gilbertson and 4 others and said, you can't just tie it to actual notice. There was a washout in the road. This nice lady went out and put a sign up. Said there's, close the road. It's closed. Notified somebody at the city, at the township, Howard Township. And they didn't do anything. Then the sign got knocked down, and Mr. Fritz drove into the washout and got injured. And the trial court said, well, you have to have actual notice. So you have to have somebody confess, basically, that we knew. And the Supreme Court reversed and said, no. We're talking about constructive or implied notice, and there was enough. And they said, first of all, as to questions of fact, says the burden of proof is upon the movement, the city, to show clearly there's no genuine issue of material facts is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Then they went on, and they said, referred to Keel. And it's the Keel versus DeSmet Township, and said, obviously the main obligation of a county under this statute, 31-32-10, is to repair all defects in a county highway which endanger the safety of the public travel. So as a result, it dovetails. It dovetails in that I think it answers your question, Justice, and that is it's the interpretation of the statute is all defects. And then they go on to talk about notice. And when they talk about notice, they say, the trial court concluded that since Township did not have actual knowledge of the sign was missing, there was no reason for a jury to speculate on whether the missing sign was adequate. We disagree. And then they talk about the proximate cause is a jury question. We did not get that opportunity.
And Mr. Beardsley, I must just ask you back to the statutory interpretation issue. And I understand your argument. And in the case that you cited, it was a little bit easier. I'll take this off in case I'm sorry.
I have great hearing anyway.
It was a little bit easier in that case because we were dealing with one washout. And I hear your argument here about this. This was really a systemic problem that the city had with numerous grates along this highway being at issue. So where, when you're applying the statutes, do you draw the parameter? Because when it goes on to speak about the city's duty then to remedy the damage, and we're talking about a highway here, a street, with numerous grates, where then? I mean, is it your argument that anywhere along that entire stretch of highway, if there was some notice of a problem with a specific grate or a number of grates, that then they now have an obligation to repair everything? And I just want to get a sense of what the parameters are of what you're arguing here.
Thank you. Yes, Justice. The first, I'm old and so I go to statutes. The first thing is it says any highway that is damaged. It doesn't say any spot in the highway is damaged. There's no limiting at all. And so they want to go, well, it's a long highway. Well, it's only 1.3 miles, this section. But the point is that if it's damaged and they have notice, and we believe they do, why do we know that? We know they have damage because 25 feet over, they pulled it out like they were supposed to and put the correct one in this perpendicular.
You'll have to, we're on the internet. So
I'm sorry.
Hang on the mic.
I moved over 25 feet.
I'll give you a little leeway, but you were dancing too far away.
No, you're exactly right, Jess. Thank you, Jeff. So 25 feet away, they pulled it out, put a new one in, and then it was safe. Then, as you go down the road, there are some with these taken completely off. Some are taken partially off. And yes, if there's a defect in any highway, they have a duty to not only warn, but they have a duty to repair. So we can't come here. We didn't write this statute, and the justices didn't write the statute. It says if any highway is damaged, if it's damaged, it's just like a bridge. If you had a series of holes and a person fell in one hole, and there's another hole and another hole, and they've worked on them but didn't maintain them, they're responsible for them. In fact, the 30B6 witness said, yes, we're responsible for the maintenance of that. So in this case, it stands for the principle that you have notice. This is Fritz. If you have notice, constructive notice, you get a chance to go to explain it to a jury and let them decide. In fact, as to whether it's constructive notice or actual notice, this very case quotes Clemenson versus Union County, and it says, our statute, forerunner to SDCL 31-3210, does not expressly require actual notice of a defect in the highway. And by the great weight of authority is held that unless actual notice required by a statute, constructive or implied notice is sufficient. There's no question that Judge Brown used the wrong standard. One, he didn't use any highway. Two, he in fact refers to in his opinion to implied notice by saying the city realized it had problems with the grates back in 2007. That's right after he says East St. Patrick Street was built with a dangerous grate system. So then the city recognized it. The city goes out there and says they did weld prior to this incident, and then they didn't maintain those welds. And then before we got to test it, they took the grate out and tossed it in a fashion that it's destroyed. And in fact, their 30B6 witness says, yes, it's effectively destroyed because we can't identify it.
Mr. Beardsley, I want to ask you just about the factual record in this case. There's a number of photographs that were introduced, and I understand those were taken, I think, by you or someone on
two
your
sets, plan. By the way.
Okay, there's two sets. So there's one set taken about 30 days after the accident, right in that time frame?
They were both taken in October. This happened July 27th, okay. So roughly.
Okay. So that's all the photographs we have in the record, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then my understanding is then there was another trip out at some point in time to inspect those again?
Another what?
Another trip out. Was there another time that you or someone else on your behalf went out and inspected those grates again before they were removed or replaced? That's
no.
The only time you went out?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay. And so the photographs that we have, there's a number of those that show damage.
Yes.
And, you know, miscellaneous pieces missing and some welding evidence. Grate 4 doesn't show that. Do you have a proximate cause issue on Grate 4? And if not, why not?
The reason we don't have a proximate cause issue is this. You can't tell from a photo, and we will have testimony. You cannot tell from a photo. And the reason you can't tell from a photo is that they get grease on a metal object you're trying to weld, won't weld at all. In fact, when I examined their so-called expert who had never seen the grate, and it's another point that it was destroyed because they didn't even show him the grate, and he said it can be dust, it can be oil, it can be grease, it can be temperature, it can be wind. There's all sorts of reasons that you may not see it in a photograph, and we don't get to test it. If we had been able to test it before they destroyed it, then we could tell the temperature difference in the grate. So here's our proof. Our proof is that they have testified, their 30B6 witness and others, four of them, that you don't weld, skip, weld, skip. In addition, sorry, I'm moving away again. In addition, over there 25 feet away, they pulled it out and put the right one in. And finally, they admitted that they welded on this grate. They admitted in their answer they welded on this grate. You know what they're saying? They're saying it was subsequent. Well, now that's a question of fact as well, because when did you weld on the grate? And why would they weld on the grate when the time cards don't show any welding on the grate after this happened? The time cards show removal, and the order was by Dale Tech, the city engineer, remove them. So there, you tell me these workers are going to go out there and go, he's just the city engineer. Ignore him and start welding on him, then remove him and get rid of him. That makes no sense. There's no logic to it.
I'm having a little trouble with the spoliation issue and the removal. So didn't you send a letter demanding that they do something about these grates after you had witnessed them?
Absolutely. And you know why? We didn't want other people hurt.
But so why, if it was such a critical, important piece of evidence, why, when you viewed it then, did you not request that be preserved?
Well, we had given them notice of the lawsuit. We had given them notice of the grade she had gone in that grade. Nowhere in our imagination would you think you'd pull the grades out, throw them in a way that they'd be destroyed. So we wanted to make sure to get a letter out to say, we don't want anybody like a child or anybody to go in those dangerous grades again, so you need to fix them. And when they removed them, no way would we think they'd just toss them wherever they wanted. We asked that they be fixed so people didn't get hurt. And then they took it and removed it in such a fashion, we'll never know which one it is. And Justice, I think you had a question too. I'm getting close.
You're... I did, but keep going because I think I've got your position. I do have one more, but I'm going to let you continue.
Well, I got 8 seconds, so I got to be quick, Judge.
It's now or never.
I'll catch you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Beardsley. Mr. Galbraith, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel, I would be remiss if I did not start with the fact that I heard some discussion this morning that perhaps there's not a December oral argument calendar. I've been in front of this court, I think, 4 times now. Most of the faces are now new, at least in this context. One has been very familiar throughout my entire career. I am humbled. Should this be the last time we're on the record to say on behalf of the state of South Dakota, the state bar, and the legal community, thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, for your service to all of us.
Thank you. And this is my last hurrah, by the way.
With respect to this case, I'll try not to wander because we all are trying to picture East St. Patrick Street in Rapid City, and we walk around with that. The photographs that have been provided, at least on our side, it is true that October 1st, October 5th, and October 17th have all been thrown out as far as the date these photographs were taken. And we're not exactly sure which is which, but we all agree that those photographs depict as closely as possible the state of those grates on the date of the accident, and that to the extent anything was done after those photographs. And so the photographs that we have provided, they're in our appendix of our brief, I believe at B, they're all the plaintiff's photographs. The plaintiff's counsel did a phenomenal job of documenting this, and they started on the south side of East St. Patrick Street at Campbell, and they laid a card down and they took a photograph, 1, 2, 3, 4, through 15. And then they crossed to the north side of East St. Patrick Street and came back, this time from east to west, A, B, C, D, all the way through O. And even here today in argument, we hear lots of discussions of, Mr. Brumbaugh said, these grates were welded on, these grates. That's the biggest distinction that the parties had both in front of the trial court and now seemingly in front of this court is, are we talking about these grates or are we talking about the grate in question? I submit to this court that we're actually restricted in doing so by the lower court's decisions and the appeals that have been made to this court. In Judge Brown's order granting the motion to dismiss, which has not been appealed, Judge Brown said, the motion to amend complaint is hereby granted. The matter shall proceed on those allegations in the plaintiff's proposed amended complaint, which allege damage to the storm drain grate, singular, which is subject to this litigation. The amended complaint then, and we've identified in the briefing, changed or added one paragraph, paragraph 25. The amended complaint says in paragraph 25, defendant knew or should have known that the welded crossbars on the grate in question were ripped off and thereby damaged. It continued on. The court's decision on the motion to dismiss and the amended complaint then thereby establishing notice of the claims being litigated, restricted the issue to the grade in question. We believe that the statute also requires that, But from a jurisdictional perspective, we have to get over that hurdle first. As Justice Salter had indicated, and I think he said he wanted to discuss with both parties, he said, what is the damage? And then what is the notice of that damage? Judge Brown had essentially the same question. Judge Brown stated, I apologize, I had it marked. This court keeps circling back to the issue of notice, but specifically notice of what? Notice of a design flaw that was birthed with the road, a self-realized belief that the parallel grates are a horrible idea because of the inherent dangers they pose to bicycles riding on the road. The review of relevant case law leads this court to conclude material relevant notice does not relate to notice or knowledge of defects in the highway that were birthed with the road. A defective design, no matter how egregious or even obvious, cannot be the basis for municipal liability. The parties all agree on that. We agree on the progeny of what came before SDCL 323110, this court's decision in Holm about 12 years ago, and what that has done to the jurisprudence. And so the question becomes, what is the damage? Is the damage just the very parallel nature of the bars? Or is the damage the crossbars? And that's what Judge Brown continued to struggle with all the way through the end of the case, where he said the plaintiffs continue to say the same thing. They continue to say that the notice of the damage was the bike master plan, was the 2007 design criteria manual standards. And we sit here now and we say, well, gosh, 25 feet, there was a perpendicular grade in place. That is true. That's what design criteria standards for new construction are. When new construction is completed in Rapid City or Pennington County or Hughes County or anywhere, we have design criteria manuals as to what the contractors must do. And those manuals since 2007 have called for the placement of perpendicular grates. What those manuals don't say is immediately go tear up every road you have that's not in compliance with our new design criteria manual. Every jurisdiction in South Dakota would never finish construction of a road.
Could the damage be, I'm sorry, you're taking me great, we shouldn't have stopped. I've got a good question for you here. Could the damage be, as Mr. Beardley suggests, the installation of the crossbars on the parallel grades, and then the notice is the realization that those crossbars are frequently themselves damaged by snow plows. And in this way, the highway, if not this exact grate, the highway becomes damaged by virtue of the plows running over it. And as I understand his argument, he could do a much better job than me, but as I understand his argument, it's almost as if he suggests, hey, this statute isn't so much statute that lists and describes a claim of liability, it's a duty statute. So that's what it is, and from that we infer the claim that they're making, and in that regard, the highway is the highway. It's a much bigger, broader concept. That seems to be so.
I think we have to go back briefly then and talk about the timeline also. We know that in 2004, the city took over this road from the state. We have the leap from the plaintiffs that then says, well, I showed you a picture of grade 10 and grade 11, and you said, yes, there's welds on these grates are old. That is true. Don Brumbaugh said that. He also said in his affidavit, which the plaintiffs say, you just can't consider it because it was contrary to his testimony. But if you look at it, it wasn't. We did not weld on grade 4. And the grates that existed east of Rapid Creek, we did not do those. Those are old welds. And so as we sit here, we all agree that grates 11, 14, 15, C, D, F, and G, those have welded crossbars on them. And yes, Justice Salter, I do believe if Julie Godbee had fell into grate 15, that there absolutely would be a fact question and an issue that we would be presenting to the jury as to whether or not there was notice of damage.
Both parties have a very convicted position about whether there was welds up and down the highway or not. And then That brings up sort of this hot potato of the missing great. And the question then becomes, in some ways, I hear the arguments sort of bringing into focus, which party should bear the burden of not having the great? Should it be the plaintiff, or should it be the party that had control of the great? Leaving apart spoliation or adverse inferences, just can you prove as a factual matter whether this had a weld on it or not? So at some point, I think that's part of the case. A little bit of a hot potato. Where does it land? And who bears the burden of not having more dispositive proof? The plaintiff or the party that had control?
The plaintiff bears the burden of establishing damage. The plaintiff's also going to bear the burden of establishing causation, and I think Justice Devaney was the one that got there. If we're going to establish damage to Great 15, and Julie Godby fell in Great 15, there is causation. If we're going to establish damage to Great 15 and Julie Godby fell in Great 4, there is not. Now, on the issue of the greats and who should have the greats, there is an interesting thing to note, because there's more to the timeline than what's been presented so far, but it is in the record. The accident happened on July 27th of 2015. The city got notice on September 29th. Thereafter, the plaintiffs took pictures, the city took pictures, all right at the beginning of October. We've produced the time cards for the city employees, which say St. Patrick Street greats on October 21st, 23rd, 26th, and 27th. And Mr. Beardsley says, well, Dale Tech said they took them out when they got my letter, so they had to have taken them out. He ignores a letter. It's in the record. It's cited in my reply brief, but the affidavit, which contains the record, I believe is at settled record 2049. It's a letter from Mr. Beardsley on March 3rd of 2016. So as we go through the timeline, accident in July, photos in early October, work by the city employees at the end of October, which the city says we welded crossbars on because Mr. Beardsley told us we needed to do something, and we went and did something. And he says, no, you took them out. If those grates were taken out in October of 2015, why would a letter get sent that reads, I am assuming that my correspondence, again, this is March 3rd of 16, I am assuming that my correspondence is probably an annoyance to some people. I am afraid the annoyance is going to continue if those grates aren't fixed. March of 16. I indicated in earlier correspondence that it was an incredible tragedy to Julie Godby, but there's no need to have further tragedies to other cyclists, including little children whose bikes were entered these deficient grates. Obviously, there is no program initiated by the city to ensure that the grates are safe. A program of maintenance has always been and will continue to be necessary until all the grates are changed to meet code. Please call me so we can visit about this matter. Please confirm to me that someone from the city is actually inspecting these grates and that repairs are being done immediately. My clients and I are not prepared to sit idly by and watch other people get killed or maimed by these ridiculous grates that are not up to code. In response to Mr. Beardsley's letter of March 3rd, 2016, he said, do something. The city went and took them out.
Well, actually, the record, nobody at the city could say when they were taken out. Isn't that true? Other than it was sometime before the end of 2016. Plaintiffs asked four different witnesses from the city, and they all said, don't know. Don't know if they were welded. Don't know if they were taken out. I mean, the reality of it is the city employees really didn't indicate they knew anything. And even the 30B6 witness took the position of, yeah, we don't know when they were taken out. I just remember I was told to take them out. Isn't that really what the facts are?
And time frames with respect to these are always interesting when you're asking witnesses about 3 years later. But we have Mr. Beardsley's letter. Not that I want to make Mr. Beardsley a witness to the case, but certainly if we get a remand, perhaps now that's going to be an issue, because we have his letter sent and his clients, apparently in conjunction with him, maybe they can testify to this, that on March 3rd of 16, those grates were still in place.
So why does that matter in the least?
I don't believe that it does.
If the point of it all is that the grates not available to be inspected, do we need to solve the factual matter of who done it as far as taking them out or when? The principal point, as I understand it, is that the grates aren't available to more clearly, perhaps just positively, understand whether they were great, whether they were welded upon or not. They're just not there. So now the question becomes, is there enough evidence, though, from what is known so that a party, the plaintiff in this case, could make out a factual argument for a fact finder that they have been welded upon and their absence is evidence of damage under the statute.
No, there is not.
That's where my, I thought I was speaking only for myself.
And so we had a welding professor come in and testify that he's reviewed the pictures of all of the photographs. We've provided some of his analysis in the brief. He's identified the grates to the east of Rapid Creek where there was evidence of welds. He's identified grate 4 where he says there is no evidence of a weld on this grate.
Isn't that a fact question for the jury?
Not if there's no contrary facts. There's always fact questions, but if one side doesn't come and produce their facts, we know on summary judgment that even a non-movement can't sit idly by. If they will have the burden of proof on something at trial, they must bring forth specific facts to show that there was evidence.
The apparent rejoinder is they're unable to do so because the grate's gone.
Well, but we go back that if we go back to that, the grate's not gone. And so the thing that simply is still left out is until this litigation was filed, the city did not know which grate that Mrs. Godby fell in. The city knew it was a grate on East St. Patrick Street, somewhere in that vicinity. And so when the city removed them, at Mr. Beardsley's insistence, they kept all of them. Mr. Beardsley and I went and looked at them. No, we don't know which one came from, because they didn't know. They kept all of the grates that are in these photographs, and they put them in a yard and said, here they are. And so that's where, if we get back into that, but still, we look at, and the evidence that was produced during the trial court level is Mr. Beardsley got up during the summary judgment motion and said, I have a rebuttal expert. He will testify, and identified what he thinks he will testify to. No affidavit, no testimony, no disclosure even. And so the plaintiff has to put facts in the record to identify that there was damage, and we believe that they have to do it, that there was damage to grate 4. We identified an expert that said no. They said, I have one, but I don't want to give it to you. I don't think that's the stance that a motion for summary judgment sits in.
So okay, understand that argument. Then that view is that under our case is to interpret Rule 702 out there, this would be the kind of case in your view, Mr. Where it would, the kind of testimony that's implicated would require expert, not lay testimony. Is that your view?
I also don't believe that's true. I think they needed to provide some evidence. I think if they had any evidence of an expert that was going to say something, they should have produced it. I think you and I can look at all of these photographs, and that's why we've provided all 30 of them to the court with a map. I think you can look at these photographs, and I think it's very readily ascertainable from those photographs which grates have been welded on and which haven't.
So then that's my question. We have photographs. We don't have the actual grates, grate 4, which is the grate in question. We have evidence that maybe some of these straps may have been welded on years ago. I think Brumbaugh said maybe even before the city took over, there may have been straps welded on. So. And they talked about how they're temporary. They talked about how the snow plows can go by and rip the welds off and things like that. So we've got a picture of a grate, but then in the context of all the other evidence, jury can draw some inferences. And should this court be the one that says, you know what, we can tell from the photos there's no welding on there? Is that enough? Or has that become a jury question at that point?
I don't believe a jury can draw that inference. And the plaintiffs do a very good job of trying to confuse the issues. The witnesses testified they wouldn't do this one and this one, but skip that one. They didn't. There is a very identified map that indicates that Rapid Creek runs right through the middle of the photographs they taken. And someone, because Don Brumbaugh says it wasn't the city, someone welded straps on the grates to the east of Rapid Creek. And there is zero evidence of a single strap on any of the grates to the west of Rapid Creek. And that's where I do think we get into the Kyle v. DeSmit Township case. And that one dealt with signage, not straps on grates. But in that case, the court said, We're going to give government entities a certain level of discretion in deciding where to put a sign and where to put a guardrail or where to weld straps on a grate. And we're not going to second guess that. And so if they decide to do it east of Rapid Creek, but not west of Rapid Creek, that cannot make a grate west of Rapid Creek damaged simply because they didn't put the same straps on that they put on to the east.
So is your argument then in this regard that the east and west portions are two distinct parts of the highway and they're different or what? Because in order, you know, I'm just kind of trying to figure that out in the context of the arguments that we have in front of us. Is that the view? That the highway has two constituent parts, the east and the west? And
my view is that the plaintiff has to provide evidence of damage to the area where they were injured. And so the reply brief almost suggests, gosh, let's make it a mile. This court has said that the legislature got rid of common law liability and made liability statutory in SDCL 3132.10, and the legislature has identified that. The legislature didn't identify a one-mile test. They're trying to get the court to add that into a statute which sets the city's or any municipality's liability. The legislature said damage, and they said if there's damage, put a guard over it or repair it. They didn't say walk the next mile of the road to make sure there's not damage anywhere else. I think there has to be damage in this specific place before the plaintiff can establish that there is any municipal liability.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbreth. Your time has expired. Mr. Beardsley, you have 10 minutes to rebuttal.
May it please the court again. Thank you. Hard to know where to start because you can't tell from a photo. We made a motion to exclude that expert because he's never seen the grate. He's never tested the grate. He hasn't taken the temperatures around the spots where they would put the grate. So we made a motion to exclude it. The judge didn't even rule yet.
The brief talks a little bit about spoliation. So do you need to, and we're not there yet because we're not instructing a jury at this point.
Right.
So, but just from thinking about it, do you need the adverse inference necessarily to win, or do you just need to be able to present a factual question to the jury, regardless of whether someone intentionally got rid of it or not? You say they intentionally did it, but do you really need that to win?
I don't think so. What we need to show is circumstances. And the circumstances in this instance is we have a whole series of grates that were welded on. We have Mr. Brumbaugh testify. They welded on them before this occurred in 2015. We have across the street a grate that is perpendicular that was put in after the spec was approved in 2007, which means the city put it in. And the city has testified they did weld on these grates. So they had notice of the issue all along. And what I would like the court to consider is what it said in Fritz versus Howard. And it says, and it refers to Bland versus Davidson. We cannot infer from the statutes the county, in this instance the city, has permission to idly stand by while hazards knowingly exist on its roads. And that's exactly what they're suggesting. They're suggesting if Julie Godbee had somehow managed to get around grate four, but fell into grate whatever number they mentioned, then there'd be a case. Well, grate four was destroyed. All the grates along there intermittently were welded on. Their witness said they welded on them prior to 2015, and we have across the road. We have numerous facts that a jury can look at and decide, did they have notice and did they have constructive notice? And what Judge Brown did is ignored Fritz that says constructive notice is all you need. You do not have to have actual notice. This isn't Perry Mason where somebody raises their hand and says, I did it. Nobody's raising their hand. But what's interesting is They got rid of all the time cards are gone until after, and the time cards that they got said they removed the grades. And interestingly, when he read from my letter, and I apologize for not bringing this up to you, Justice, in your question, I asked for them to be repaired. Of course I did. My client wanted it. She wanted it repaired all across wherever they are. Why? Because she didn't want anybody else to become a quadriplegic or worse. And so I'm writing these letters to the city, pleading to tell them, fix these. Why? We don't need people injured. We don't need Mrs. Godby injured. We don't need anybody else injured. And you already have notice indicated by all of these facts we presented. The judge got the wrong standard regarding the highway.
About notice. So I understand from your argument, it's pretty clear that you think notice occurred a long time before the accident in this case. And in any event, it would really only just have to be that short 48-hour window prior to something happening, so read the statute. But when, at what point in time along the continuum would you say notice, even in a constructive sense, as you argue? What's your argument or your view about when and at what point the city had notice?
Justice, your question's great, and I got an answer. But here's the point. Your question's great for a jury to answer, because it's a question of fact. When did they do it? It's my opinion, and I believe the evidence will show, after 2007, when they got the spec and they changed the one out across the street 25 feet away I keep wanting to move over to, and sometime prior to 2015, because Brumbaugh said we welded on these grates prior to 2015. So they had notice all along there.
That's really a jury question, though, because if, and I don't know that it's dispositive of the analysis, but if 3132.10 is a duty statute, and the duty arises only after notice and the passage of a short period of time, it seems to suggest that there might not have been a duty prior to that. Duties, as you know, are questions of law, not questions for the jury to determine. So it may well be that notice in this case has a function and has a role in determining the existence of a duty. As I say, I recognize your argument that you think happened a long time ago. I'm trying to figure out like when.
See, what's interesting is it's like one of the other justices mentioned, well, they all said they didn't know anything. You take all these depositions, they got rid of all the time cards other than the after. They got rid of, and nobody wants to admit when they welded on them. But the point was that they were. And when Mr. Brumbaugh testified to that, then I had the others that I deposed say, well, you don't disagree with Mr. Brumbaugh, do you? No. They don't disagree with Mr. Brumbaugh, who ran that program at the time. He's retired, but they designated him as 30B6 witness. So the issue is, yes, there's a duty from the statute when it's damaged. There's a question, and the trial court got it wrong regarding notice. So what happens is, and these are all great questions, if you get the standard wrong, whether it's constructive notice required or actual notice required, all these other facts will come to light at trial, and we have some of them. But it's interesting because these young guys that, my son and Elliot, when we were sitting around talking about it last night, they said, yeah, and then there's this, this, and this. And I said, you know what? If they use the wrong standard down below, we don't even get to those. But we have them presented to you. But the fact of the matter is, they use the wrong standard. Can't be just, it has to be any highway. And he didn't use that. And it has to be constructive notice and not just actual notice. And so the wrong standard was used. I don't know if that, did that answer your question? I don't think you think I answered it.
Way to read the statutes, the duty arises within 48 hours, so beyond 2 days. Under that theory, you really only need to have, the student only really have to have notice 48 hours prior to the accident. So we're not talking about a lot of time. I was just curious if you had, I don't even know if this is positive, but anything else, I was curious about whether you had a view.
I have
at some point, you probably need to put it.
I have a parameter. And we believe notice always goes all the way back to 1992, but our parameter is 2007 when the spec changed, and they changed that out. 2015 when they were welding on it, and Brumbaugh said they were welding before this occurred. I thought it was interesting that, Justice, you replied, you indicated it was sort of a hot potato. We didn't have any control over that grate. We asked that they be repaired so nobody fell on them. We didn't say remove them and destroy them. And so the fact of the matter is that we did our duty. The city didn't do their duty. The city didn't do their duty to protect these citizens. They're riding bicycles down the lane. They told them to ride there. They provided a trap and left a trap because these were defective and the highway was damaged.
Quick question, Mr. Beardsley, on the removal of the grates.
Yeah.
You know, the one part of the spoliation and the adverse inference that can be drawn from that, it's not just intentional conduct. It requires bad faith. So can you, where in the record or what can you point us to that would show that, so that we, if we were, could consider that in the summary judgment decision here, where is the bad faith beyond just intentional removal, negligent removal, but bad faith?
Bad faith is a, in our opinion, a question for the jury. And why is it a question for the jury? Because they can figure out intent. So if I write a letter and say, would you repair these so people don't get injured? And they take them and remove them and put them in such a fashion nobody can identify them. You can couple that with the fact that they have already gotten rid of other records. And it's my opinion that if you take, I like to use the analogy of toothpicks, but I think tires are even better. You got 100, you got 30 tires. And it's a bad tire. And you take the tires and you throw them all into a pile, and you let it snow, rain, sleet, everything, and you can't figure out which tire we're talking about, you've destroyed it. And you can't, after you get notice of the injury, after you get a lawsuit going, after you get all this going, you take the evidence that's the main piece to prove that it was welded on, and we should have to prove that was the only one because we have all the others that were welded on. As a result, they've taken this, destroyed the evidence, and then they go, well, it really wasn't that big a deal.
And on that point, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I understand Justice Jensen wishes to make a statement.
Thank you, Chief. Before we adjourn today, this is the last, as counsel already referenced, this is the last term and last session that Chief Justice Gilbertson is going to be serving with this court, and I think each of your colleagues wanted to take just a minute or two and express our appreciation to you. And from my perspective, you know, in the 20 years as chief and 25 plus years serving as a justice on this court, you've transformed this court. You've transformed the UJS, and your legacy is, I would say, indelibly stamped on both this court and the UJS for many, many, many years, and for that I thank you. From a personal standpoint, it has been my pleasure and privilege to learn from you and to serve with you. So thank you, and best wishes in your future endeavors.
Thank you.
Can you clap? We're not finished because I think Justice Kern, I think everybody's going to take it.
They've told me they all want their shot.
Oh, okay. Well,
you know, I would echo the beautiful sentiments just expressed by Justice Jensen. You have had an incredible career. You are the longest running Chief Justice currently in the nation. You have served as the Chief of the Council of Chief Justices, the head or the director of the National Center for State Courts. You have been a true public servant who has devoted really your life to the service and the betterment of our justice system. You have been absolutely instrumental in bringing specialty courts into South Dakota, our drug courts, our DUI courts, our veterans courts, now our mental health courts, benefiting thousands of people. You've brought attorneys into the rural counties of this state. There are 27 counties blessed by your involvement in partnership with the legislature and the local governments in bringing this reality to give people access to justice. You have brought, in partnership with the Helmsley Foundation, telehealth into our into the service of those who struggle with their mental health, aiding the justice system. You have authored in excess of and been involved in deciding, rather, you've been involved in deciding over 700 opinions. That's your authorship, 700 opinions. That's incredible. You have served with humility and integrity, devoted to the federal and state constitution and the rule of law. And you've left the justice system in our state a better place. And it's been an honor and a privilege to serve with you as my friend and my mentor through these years. And I am grateful for your service and all that you have done and the opportunity to serve with you.
It's well said, and I'm grateful for the chance to add a thought or two in addition. And I would simply say this, Chief, I think as we reflect on your years of distinguished service, it's easy to think about the long list of honors and achievements, many of which I think are truly extraordinary. I will enjoy looking back on those accomplishments with you and with the others as your time on the court draws to a close. But I tend to think first about David Gilbertson as a person of great ability and more fundamentally great humility and kindness and selflessness, judging as you do without fear or favor, and always acting in all of your dealings without pretense. Our court, the state judiciary, and the people of South Dakota owe our gratitude to you for your service and to your family, the countless ways in which they've supported your work over the years and made it possible for you to do what you do. Thank you.
I could just say ditto, but I'll just add a little bit more. Also, my personal, personally and professionally, I thank you for your wisdom and your insight and for being our fearless leader over so many years and getting us through hard times, amazing advances in our system, and it is an indelible mark. And so I would just leave with your own words here that I think we can all agree with. You have fought the good fight. You have finished the race, although we're going to keep calling you back, maybe on occasion. And you've kept the faith. Well done.
Well, I wasn't going to say anything, but I have just maybe a word or two. It occurred to me in the last couple of weeks that even at my advanced age, over half my life has been spent wearing a judicial robe, and over 35 years. And through that, I've been able to come into contact with some of the finest people I've ever met in my life, fellow justices, attorneys, and I guess I'm incredibly blessed because I know very few people when they are 71 years old that can say, as far as their career selection, they have no regrets. I have no regrets. And I would not have been able to accomplish any of this without the support of my wife and family. I welcome the new Chief Justice in January, and Justice Myron will replace me on the 5th Supreme Court District. Both are clearly definite upgrades. And so with that, I bid you all a fond farewell.
This has got to be the longest recess. I usually just say case over in recess.
Better take that.